listening to The Realist Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Sunday, February 10th, 2019, and this is a live edition of The Realist Report, broadcast here on Eurofolk Radio. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of The Realist Report podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. I encourage listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. Okay, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this evening. Nick Kollerstrom is joining us all the way from the United Kingdom. Nick is a former professor and an author who has dealt with some of the most controversial topics of our time, including the infamous alleged terrorist attack in London, commonly known as the 7/7 terrorist attack, which is essentially the British version of 9/11,
and also
the alleged Holocaust narrative of World War II. Nick, welcome to the program, sir. How are you this evening?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back again, John. And by the way, I do agree with you about the Barnes Review being a really good independent history journal to subscribe to. Anyone who wants revision of history and controversial ideas, presentation that's vitally, history that's important to us, history that really matters. Yeah, I do recommend the Barnes Review, right?
Yes, absolutely. The Barnes Review is an outstanding publication. I've been a subscriber since, I believe, 2010, and I've also contributed to the magazine a few times over the years. So it's, you know, it is a great publication, and of course, I do encourage people to subscribe. In fact, the Barnes Review, if I'm not mistaken, and we can get into this as we proceed here, I know the Barnes Review does sell your book, Breaking the Spell, which deals with the alleged Holocaust.
I think it's about the
narrative.
Last place it does, because that got banned on Amazon, along with all the revisionist books. That they certainly banned all of them. I think Barnes Review is about the last place that really sells that book.
Yes.
It was a real bestseller. It was a real revisionist bestseller, that. It got clobbered by being banned by Amazon. But I think it is still selling a bit with Barnes Review. My publisher is just bringing out a new edition and just translating it into German. So, you know, I'm very pleased with that work, yeah.
Oh, very good. Yeah, and you know what? We will definitely talk more about that book as we proceed here. One thing I wanted to say right off the bat is I wanted to thank you for joining me. I know it's, 11 p.m. on a Sunday evening for you. It's 3 p.m. Pacific for me. So,
oh, that's all right. Yeah,
yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. And it has been a while since we last spoke. I know you were on my program. I want to say it was in sometime in 2014. So it's been, you know, close to 5 years ago since the last time we spoke, at least on the air.
Right.
And this was the last time we spoke. You had yet to publish Breaking the Spell, your book dealing with the alleged Holocaust narrative.
Yeah.
The first time we spoke, we pretty much focused exclusively on the alleged 7/7 terrorist attack. We also kind of talked about your background and your professional experience. But you know what? Since it's been so long, and we may have some new listeners, maybe some people that have never heard of your work or heard our conversation in the past, could you just briefly maybe take, you know, maybe 5 minutes at the most, and just talk about your background and your professional experience
I think of myself as a science historian. I've got 2 degrees in history and science, I feel it's very important for our culture to have a perspective on how science has developed and how it's kind of gone wrong. In previous centuries, people always felt science was a beneficial enterprise. It was going to prove everything and help us all out. And it's somehow gone wrong now. It's somehow in the hands of the wrong people, or it's producing wrong kind of stuff, and people aren't very happy about it now. So I think it's very important to have that kind of critique. So I feel that qualification I've got is quite important. And I tackle, in this 21st century, the great massive deceptions that are put upon us, especially Britain and America. I think we're the two of the worst nations for creating deceptive stories to justify war. And it's terribly important for citizens to grapple with the illusions which your own government gives you, terrible illusions about some enemy they're cooking up. And if you have got an enemy, it's within our own government, you know. We need some kind of movement, some kind of truth movement, which is going to expose the actions of our government in these fictitious stories.
Yes.
But obviously real people die. Well, that makes it, you know, gives a very solemn air to it all. As you say, I came in really with the London bombing story and did a book on that. And I followed it up with one called False Flags Over Europe, or the American edition is called Chronicles of False Flag Terror, published by Jim Betzer's outfit. And that is a whole review of European fabricated terror. It's been going on all over Europe now. It's terrific. Phantom events with actors and dummies and, you know, paid witnesses. It's a massive business now. Anything they want to demonize, anything they want to delegitimize, the government will construct these kind of events. I know it's not a very pleasant subject, but I think citizens do need to be aware of it.
Yes, absolutely. And you have been covering a lot of these types of issues for a number of years. I have a question. Really, the 7/7 attack, that was when you really became public and you were questioning, you know, this major alleged terrorist attack. And this was at a time when you were still working in a university setting, correct?
Right. Yeah. I was a research fellow at University College London, and the whole London bombing story happened just on my doorstep. I really knew that part of London. So I sort of got drawn into it. But I think Academ wasn't very happy about it. I think that's part of the reason they chucked me out, you know.
Oh, no doubt.
What is derisively called conspiracy theory is actually a quest for deeper truth of what is happening to our society.
Yeah, you know, I have a question about your experience on campus. I went to the University of Nebraska and got a degree it was basically international relations.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and I got to study abroad a couple of times. I had a really good college experience. I mean, I had a lot of fun. I got to travel quite a bit. I was always a pretty good student. I think I graduated with a 3.75 GPA, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember off the top of my head. It was something like that anyways. So I had a good experience on campus. I was not really dealing critically with a lot of these, you know, bigger issues like 9/11, for example, or the Holocaust, for another example. But I do think that I got a pretty solid education. I was very open-minded. And once I really graduated from college and I got my own computer, I was able to sit down and kind of pursue whatever I wanted at that point. You know, when you're in college, you're kind of being told what to read, what to discuss.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
But when you're, you know, kind of on your own, you can get into any number of topics. And the internet has been so powerful in allowing us to do that, allowing us to sit down and really do our own research and start our own websites and our own blogs and become, you know, sort of citizen journalists or, you know, like even amateur, like historians to a certain extent. So I'm curious how when we see, you know, modern college environments where it's very politically correct, right? I mean, you can't question certain things. You can't talk about certain things. This prevailing sort of anti-white, even anti-intellectual type perspective, you know, where again, you just can't question certain things. You have to take for face value at other things.
It's relatively recent. That's more recently than I was at college.
Right. Yeah. And that was kind of my question. How has it changed? I mean, was this stifling political correctness prevalent when you were on campus?
Well, I didn't notice it so much. What used to puzzle me was that my old university, Cambridge, supposed to have all these brilliant, forward-looking students, you know, the intellectuals of tomorrow. They never, ever had any talk about 9/11 truth. That simply not happened on that university. And I find that very hard to understand. I mean, I think when we were at college, we didn't have a fear of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing in that kind of way. You know, we felt it was a kind of adventure being at college, and there wasn't anything you were afraid to look at. And now it's just unthinkable to have that kind of for 9/11 truth to be connected with almost any university. We have got a university professor being denounced and probably chucked out of his college in this country recently because he made some comments about 9/11 truth. But I mean, let's hope we're getting to a stage where the thing can go a bit more mainstream. I mean, I find it very extraordinary the way it hasn't. I was in a Stop the War group at University College London, we should discuss about, and all they did really was march. Left-wing stuff is okay on college, you know, it's okay to be socialist and left-wing, and that is acceptable. I think partly because of the mixed culture, different cultural backgrounds, you know, it won't create a... it will be acceptable. So I was always fairly apolitical, middle of the road. I was always anti-war, but I never felt that it was politically dangerous, you know. Perhaps that's why I was rather naive. I published a couple of articles on then, as you know, John, about the Zyklon, use of cyanide Zyklon at Auschwitz and how it was remembered in the walls. It's still there in the walls. I found that really fascinating angle on the whole story. I've never been interested in World War II at all, you know, or no interest in, you know, the Nazis or anything, absolutely none. But when I realised there was this very clear chemical angle of the cyanide Zyklon used as an insecticide, and it's still soaked up into the walls and it's still there, and people are measuring it, I felt that was a really good science angle, and actually just what a science historian should be looking at. And so I did a couple of articles. I did three articles on it, and that got me chucked out and damned all over the media and stuff, you know. And
sure,
there was all this,
we
found a Nazi crap. So that was like the big shock of my life. I think I was rather naive, not realizing something like that would happen. People said I was very naive.
Yeah, you know what? I was kind of the same way. I mean, once I really kind of started researching 9/11 and taking a second look at that alleged event, which has had, you know, certainly from an American perspective, it's had such a profound influence on our society, on the direction of our society.
On the whole world.
True, definitely on the whole world. And it's been like the main paradigm that our foreign policy has been, you know, conducted around. You know, this idea that
Very much,
Muslim terrorists attacked us, therefore we need to go into the Middle East and overthrow all these governments, you know, destroy all these nations, etc. It's really insane.
Well, it's so important for Americans to understand what's going on. It's 20 years from 2000, when Blueprint for New American Century was first published, and it was Global Vision 20 up for 2020. That was what the neocon reports were about. They published this just before 9/11 event, it was an audacious plan for full spectrum dominance, land, sea, air, and space of the whole planet. And so they wanted American primacy. America is the only superpower, not letting any other power get its act together, and power projection across the whole planet. And 9/11 was what they needed to do that. It's so important to understand the reason why it was done. We don't need to go into too much detail about all the funny things that happened on 9/11. The important thing, it was a force projection blueprint to establish the new enemy, Al-Qaeda, which, because it hadn't actually done it, Al-Qaeda could be seen anywhere. It could be imagined anywhere. It was a new explanation of what 800 American bases were doing all around the world. You know, before that had been communism. We are now, in the last year or two, coming up to 2020, the titanic struggle. Will a global American empire be established? You know, will the Brzezinski Doctrine prevail, which is that other nations must be sort of broken up, mustn't be allowed to form alliances, resources of the world flow towards America? This is the tremendous vision of the evil vision of the neocons who planned and blueprinted the 9/11 event together with their colleagues, Zionist colleagues in Israel.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And you know what? That to me is really the most important aspect of 9/11 and really understanding why, you know, it was carried out. It was absolutely it was designed, set up and used to basically justify this pre-concocted paradigm of American foreign policy, where we had to go into the Middle East and project our power all over the world, particularly in the Middle Eastern region, basically in order to advance Israel's interests there. That's really what we've been doing.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And you know, there's all these neocon, you know, policy papers that have been written over the years, you know, leading up to 9/11, and some of them explicitly called for a new Pearl Harbor in order to kickstart it.
Yeah,
and again, that's exactly what 9/11 was. And it's very easy to piece this together. This is no secret. This is no, you know, conspiracy theory. This is very well established at this point. It's very clear. And I think, you know, you could probably talk a little bit more about 7/7. It's an event that, you know, I'm not too familiar with. I mean, I know the basics, but
what's important for Americans to understand is that after 9/11, the bogus, illusory threat of Al-Qaeda had to be carried over to Europe, you see. So you got a bombing in Madrid railway station, which is a terror strike Spain, and a whole lot of Muslims were put in jail in 2004. In 2005, you get the London bombing, and four young lads are blamed for it, and they're killed, they die, and a lot of real deaths happen. And it is terrible, certainly is really terrible, but the story is bogus. It's so important. The new paradigm is the main art form of the 21st century. It's important people to appreciate this. A whole lot of government funding goes into the design, the creative design of these events, and people kind of expect terror in their newspapers. They won't buy a paper if it just says, oh, we all had a good time. No, that they need fear and terror. This is a strange negative condition we're in, and the government produces these fabricated terror events to grab your attention and stop you thinking about more important things in life, keep you in a condition of fear. That's what the empire needs. Now, this is a very terrible statement. The empire needs your fear, and partly to stop you realizing how bogus the things they're telling you are, and how useless are their politicians. If you're in a state of fear, you will kind of take notice of them. So we've had this terrific series of fabricated terror events. My book looks at how there's a big transition just around the time of Sandy Hook in America and the Boston Marathon bombing, where you started to get actors and dummies used instead of real deaths. And that was a huge change, because in the first decade of the 21st century, you always had gruesome real deaths. And real bombs would go off, although you wouldn't find out who set them off, right? And we had this new concept of state-fabricated terror, whereby drills were set up, rehearsal drills, and the drills would then go live at the event. The drills synchronized with the event and would go live, and that was state-fabricated terror.
Okay? Yeah.
You never quite know who did it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And we've seen a lot of, I've described it as media fakery, media deception, where an event is presented to the public via the news media as a real, genuine event. But in reality, it's some sort of drill or some sort of basically an act, right? I mean, I think that was very clear.
Security
with
funds these rehearsals, right? Now, Sandy Hook was totally funded.
Yes.
Boston Marathon bomb was designed. You can get the blueprint of the design, the person who designed it. It was totally designed, and it was ethical within the parameters of the funding that Homeland Security gives for rehearsal for terror. The idea is that terror is going to come anyway, so you might as well prepare for it. That's the philosophy. And the trouble is, it then acquires a bit too much realism, and it spills over into newspaper headlines as if it's a real event. Once it's done that, then the actors have to realize the documents they've signed and the money they've taken means they'd better keep their mouth shut.
It's pretty incredible when you stop and think about it. And it's a very difficult concept for a lot of people to, you know, take seriously and to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, we still don't have any politicians prepared to talk about, apart from one or two geniuses like Cynthia McKinney. Broadly speaking, would you agree no politicians are really prepared to talk about this?
No, not that I'm aware of, for sure.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a central driving force, and it's why the warmongers always kind of succeed, because those, you know, more gentle people who say, look, do we really need the war? They're not able to deconstruct the fabricated terror events, which apparently have a logic whereby, oh, look, we've got to fight, haven't we? This thing is really threatening us. We've got to fight. And people need to realize that the military budgets are so huge, so enormous now, that the military takes steps to ensure and guarantee its own future by creating this theater, kind of street theater, for you to be convinced and accept that the military is protecting you.
Yeah, no doubt. And there's a number of examples of this. It was really on display, and it really caught my attention. You mentioned the alleged Sandy Hook shooting. I mean, as soon as I saw that in the media, I was like, wow, this does not seem, you know, on the up and up. There seems something very fishy about what they're telling us about this. And the more I, you know, kind of looked into it, I started, you know, I read pretty much as I could from the mainstream, watched a number of the videos of the interviews with the alleged witnesses or the alleged like survivors, family members, and some of the deceased family members that were being interviewed. And it was just so bizarre. None of it made sense. That the people did not seem genuine at all.
Has Jim Fetzer now got a lawsuit with this chap Posner?
Yes,
Posner claims to have a child. His son died at Sandy Hook. It's incredible. And Jim is saying, oh, no, he didn't. No, you haven't got the son. He's not a real – that son isn't real. He's a composite character.
Right.
Well, that's an amazing thing to be having a lawsuit, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And from what I gather, I don't know all the details of the situation, but from what I understand – Dr. Fetzer is basically telling Posner, hey, look, prove this. Prove that your son died at Sandy Hook. We'll see if this guy, Lenny Posner, is actually going to be able to do that and follow through with this. From what I also understand, Lenny Posner has sued other people in the past. And basically, once they get into court and the people he's suing, like Wolfgang Halbig, for example, they're telling the court, hey, look, you need to prove what's going on here. You need to prove that your son actually died. He drops the case because he can't, you know, maybe he's too afraid to actually get into court and actually try to prove these things. I don't know, but it is very bizarre. And just think about it. Just think about the tyrannical assault on freedom of thought, to where you're being Dr. Fetzer is essentially being sued for simply thinking critically and writing critically about this alleged event. I mean, we're just simply trying to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, when did it become a crime to question certain events? It's been a crime in Europe, for example, to question the alleged Holocaust story for decades now. And we're starting England to see that sort of mindset creep into America.
Well, one thing we can say, Britain and America isn't a crime to have realistic discussion about what people call the Holocaust. You know, I mean, you can tend to lose your job and lose your job, lose your friends. You know, certainly politically dangerous, no doubt about that. But it's not actually as such a crime, is it?
Right. No. Well, that's right. There are very powerful non-state actors that basically punish people in the United States. Certainly, I'm sure it would be similar in the UK. To where, for example, you know, take me for example. You know, I started a website, I started doing podcasts, I started writing about some of these very controversial issues.
Yeah.
And malicious third party actors would, for example, contact my employer and tell them, hey, look, you know, this guy's saying these things, he's critical of the Jews.
And then
there's negative repercussions that way. So it's not really the government.
Did you lose your job or what?
Oh yeah, it's happened a couple times in the past.
So is that the price?
I'm one of many. I mean, this is happening on an increasing scale all across the country. Yeah. I mean, it happens almost every day now, and sometimes it's like truly ridiculous things where, you know, somebody will make a comment on Facebook, you know, critical of illegal immigrants or something, or critical of like the promotion of transgenderism or homosexuality.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then the next thing you know, their employers find out and they're let go. They're fired. It's really, really tyrannical. And, you know, it's having this very suffocating effect on our ability to deal critically with various issues.
How do we get into a situation where you're not allowed to criticize transgenderism? I mean, if I made a comment about transgenders, would that put your program in jeopardy or what?
No, I don't think it would put my program in jeopardy, but you know, I think it, depending on where you work, you know, if you start saying stuff critically about transgender or any number of topics, there could be some very real repercussions. And you know, again, there's many cases of this. I've been writing about this for years now, including for American Free Press. I've written a number of articles about this topic. You know, just pointing out examples of people being fired. A teacher, for example, was fired for doing a podcast, and you know, for having, I don't even know exactly how I would describe her views, but basically, you know, kind of race realist, pro white, almost views.
Yeah,
and you know, that's
right. So it's a position where you might possibly be offending someone. It strikes me they don't have to even find somebody that you have offended. They have to say, "Oh, you might be causing hurt feelings."
Exactly,
Hurt feelings are now treated as if it's a crime. You know, which it isn't and shouldn't be. I think we need to remind the police that the definition of crime needs to be objective. This is terribly important for any idea of justice. Crime is unacceptable harm or loss, and that does not include your hurt feelings. Why not? Because that cannot be proven, demonstrated objectively in a court. The whole idea of crime and justice is that you argue it in a court and you can prove that somebody is guilty. That cannot be the case. It cannot be done at all. If you're going to get, I mean, what we have, especially rich Jews, they're able to take someone to court alleging that their feelings are hurt or alleging that some sort of trouble might possibly be caused in the future by something they've said. And it seems to be terribly important that we argue and have some dialogue with the police that this is not a crime and it must not be a crime.
Yes.
And if it does become a crime, then nobody's innocent. You know, the basic idea of justice system is that you're innocent until proved guilty. And when you get these totally nebulous concepts whereby you might be offending somebody or somebody might be upset, might possibly lead to violence or some disturbance in the future when you haven't got any evidence for that, it kind of dissolves the whole idea of justice, really, because you cannot objectively prove anything anymore. So I think it's terribly important for groups to exist which are trying to defend and affirm the basic ideas and traditions of justice.
I
think that's where we've got to. Suppose you're fired by your employees because they think they've heard a story you've criticized some group that might upset them. I think that is wrongful dismissal, and we need some way of counteracting it, you know.
Right. I agree. And I mean, I think these very stifling effects on free speech, it's going to take people to you know, standing up and doing what we're doing, having an open public conversation about these things, and not backing down and not being afraid.
I think we need more traditional right-wing political parties, and a right-wing, slightly, how should I put it, a bit more, I don't know, manly or traditional, and they would say, no, of course that isn't a crime. You're perfectly allowed to yell insults at me as much as you want, and that is not and will not be a crime. I think we need a more sort of tough attitude that police are very courageous. We want them to fight crime, real crime. We don't want them to be distracted by totally silly claims that somebody has criticized a tranny or something, or say you don't approve anal sex, for example, and you tell somebody that. You know, you don't want the police on your back or somebody claiming your job may not be secure just because you've said that.
Yes, I completely agree.
We need some sort of social movement. I don't know whether it's to do with Christian church or what, which will affirm normal traditional ideas of justice. You know, it's not anything innovative. It's just maintaining the traditional idea that you've got a right to free expression.
Yes, I completely agree. And that's what I try to champion every single time I do a podcast. Every single time I write on my website or write for the newspaper, that's exactly what I'm all about. And it's going to take people, you know, like that doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in a situation in this country, in England, where the sort of radical revolutionary people are the old fogies, the pensioners. We're not easy to threaten, you know. And the young, who are burdened with debt from colleges or whatever, they don't want to know about any stuff that may be politically dangerous, you know. So you haven't got the rebellious youth that you used to have, you know, 50 years ago. That's all gone now, isn't it?
Wow. Yeah, well, I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I'm still waiting for, you know, more people my age to get on board with some of this stuff. I do think, I mean, generally speaking, at least since I've been involved in this sort of information, this kind of space that we're operating in, I definitely have seen more and more people at least entertain what I'm saying and not be, like, offended by it. Like, back when I first got started doing this, you know, I would be on, like, Facebook and make a comment about 9/11 or something like that, and people would be upset. They'd be offended. I've lost, tons of friends as a result of stuff like this. But generally speaking, I think, you know, over the course of the past 5, 6, 7 years or whatever it is, that's becoming less and less of a problem. You know, people
If I might give a comparison here in England, it's okay for me to talk about 9/11 because it's further away, you see. So I wouldn't lose any friends over 9/11, but the London bombing, I find it, which is our equivalent, as you pointed out, I find there's so little discussion about it. I find it astonishing that it's just kind of drifted into the past now, and there's very little of value. Mine is almost the only book on, more or less the only book on the subject, Terror on the Tube, and which I'm very puzzled by. I mean, I think there should be, you know, a dozen or so different books on the subject.
Right.
And so the British people, I think, are very placid, and they get lied to so massively by the government now. I think that there's no other country which generates lies as powerful as Britain these days.
Wow, yeah. So you're saying it's even worse than here where we're at in America?
Well, let's take an example.
Because it's pretty bad here, I'll tell you that.
Let's take an example. When the Democrats wanted some dirt on Trump, you know, coming up to the last election, they wanted to try and make out some Russian collusion story, right? And how did they do it? Well, they went to Britain's MI5, Britain's military intelligence, and they asked this fellow, Christopher Steele, to concoct a story about Russians colluding with Trump. And he did that. And that was some, you know, dirty dossier, and it was used to try and discredit Trump. And they assumed that he wouldn't be elected. Then it's all come out and been exposed. It's a massive British pack of lies. But why did America want British intelligence? Why didn't they do it themselves? I think it's just a reputation Britain's got for concocting, a major ability to concoct outright lies. I mean, if you think of the 9/11 event, after 9/11, America's going to bomb Afghanistan, right? That was the plan. And the Taliban said, oh, sure, we'll give you bin Laden. Sure, we'll hand him over. Just give us some evidence that he did it, right? Because they knew bin Laden, very distinguished guest, he was in Afghanistan, had just asked America some evidence that he'd done it, and then they'd hand him over. And America said, okay, yeah, we'll do that, we'll do that. And they didn't, because they couldn't, hadn't got any evidence. So what did they do? A week before they started bombing, British intelligence came out with a crappy pack of lies about how bin Laden had done 9/11, okay? So it was a British dossier, which Tony Blair produced, that kind of saved the day, as it were, and gave America an excuse to start bombing Afghanistan.
And wow, now that's a good point, one I haven't really thought of, because I do know exactly what you're talking about. And I guess what I would say in response is that, you know, the British intelligence services have a long history of doing stuff like this, right?
Well, for hundreds of years, ever since the beginning of the First World War. The idea of intentional, deliberate mendacity, that your own troops will go out to fight and die because they're given a hate and enemy image by their own government. It's been going on deliberately, a deliberate concoction of hate propaganda since 1914. And the trouble is, when the war's finished, you can't then switch it off. They then take the credit. Oh, we helped you to win the war, didn't we? So you have to keep all these people, all these very powerful liars. Everyone now knows that dirty dossier for the Iraq war, that British intelligence made up the story of weapons of mass destruction that Iraq had got. And that was the pretext for the horrendous attack on Iraq.
Yes.
2003. More recently, John, look what's happened more recently. We've had all this Skripal story. I don't know if you followed it. They captured two Russians. One was a spy, a double agent. He'd betrayed his Russian colleagues, and he was retired in England. So British intel captured him and his daughter when his daughter came across and concocted a huge story about something called Novichok, which is a kind of science fiction type poison. There's no objective evidence anywhere other than the government's word that this has happened. And then they pretended they got evidence that the Russians done it. And they hadn't got any evidence at all. You know, absolutely none. And they managed to get 200 diplomats, Russian diplomats, expelled. Or was it 100? 100 Russian diplomats expelled from all different NATO countries around the world based on this absolute load of crap. British manufactured bogus intelligence about alleged Russian poisoning of an agent, right, just before this big football match was going to be held in Russia, you know, the international football championships. Obviously, it's the last thing they'd want, a story like that.
Right. The British intelligence agencies have been lying and using deception professionally and very skillfully for a very long time. You know, but one thing that's incredible is, like, you know, these big lies, undermining our historical narratives, our, you know, contemporary narratives. I'm thinking about 9/11, 7/7, some of these other events. Certainly the alleged Holocaust narrative of World War II. The propaganda associated with it is really powerful, and it really targets our emotions, cases. Yeah. Yeah. But it's in other cases, it's truly, like, astounding what they expect us to believe or some of the narratives they promote. Think about, for example, the insanity of, like, global war on terrorism propaganda, where it like demonizes Islam and demonizes Muslims more generally, I guess. And yet our entire political and media establishment are basically demanding that Western nations accept unlimited third world refugees, many of whom are Muslim. And, come from Islamic countries. So it's like we're supposed to go bomb and invade these countries in the Middle East. And yet, on the other hand, allow all of them to come into our countries and live become, quote unquote, citizens.
I mean, what a nightmare.
Just a total assault on your mind, I think, is really what
it is. It's a total assault on your mind. I agree with that. I mean, how could anyone devise such a nightmarish scenario of bombing their countries? And then not wanting, obviously nobody wants all these refugees to come teaming in. And how come we don't understand that is the expected consequence of bombing the countries? And what on earth has bombing the countries got to do with a war on terror? I mean, if you think somebody is terrified or promoting some sort of destabilizing, how could bombing another country help that? I mean, it's just not connected.
No, it's total insanity. I mean, really, that's what it boils down to. You know, we got about 20 minutes left, and I definitely want to get into your book about the Holocaust. And kind of to get started on that, would you say that is the most controversial topic that you've addressed, the alleged Holocaust narrative?
Oh, definitely, it's the most powerful book I've done. People come up from different continents and shake my hand and thank me for doing it. Because I was, I mean, it's a very scientific book. It's not about promoting anti-Semitism or making anyone hate it at all. It's an objective scientific survey of the greatest lie ever told, and looking at facts and figures. I mean, the breakthrough I had in doing that, because after I was thrown out of my college and I was damned by all the world and everyone said, oh, you're finished now, that's it, you're over. I then came across the idea that there were British intelligence decrypts, that Brits had been listening in radio to the broadcast from all these German labor camps for 13 months, and they'd been top secret until the mid-90s, and hardly anyone was talking about these decrypts. Historians were rather embarrassed by these decrypts, very detailed accounts of camp life, but no trace of any Holocaust going on, okay? So obviously the historians are quite embarrassed by this. So I went over to the Public Record Office, where the original archives are, and I found it quite amazing. So I published them. In a way, that is the scoop in my book. That's why it's different from the hundreds of other Holocaust books, that it has got this scoop of British intelligence decrypts, what was overheard from daily life in the camp, 1942, 1943. Basically, they were trying to get a great variety of different people mingling around in the camps, about 40% of the people Jews, other people who were Poles and Russians, German political prisoners, and they were trying to get useful work out of them. That was the purpose in these great labor camps, especially Auschwitz. It was a huge industrial labor camp where the work and the factories helped the German war effort. That aim was very much shattered or traumatized in 1942 by a terrific outbreak of typhus. And you suddenly got enormous mortality in the camps, and more people than they could sort of bury, or bodies they could bury or look after. And there was a sense of horror with these putrefying bodies and famine and typhus. And that is where this whole story of the Holocaust began, okay?
Yes.
The remedy, the cure for this, was very effective. There were notes coming out from German high command saying mortality at all costs must be reduced in the camps. And they had main ways they proposed of doing that was, first of all, the delousing procedure of all clothes and all bedding, all mattresses had to go through the delousing chambers, because, as you know, the typhus epidemic is caused by a little bug, and you have to kill that bug to stop the typhus. So they had all these delousing chambers with the zyklon. Suddenly, mid-42, many tons of zyklon, that is cyanide, absorbed onto in a granular form. Okay, so slight heating of the granules will release the cyanide, and this is created. It's in tins, and it's an insecticide, and it's designed to release the cyanide in a fairly safe manner. It's safe once it's in the delousing chamber, then after a couple of hours, all of the clothing and mattresses are taken out and aired for a bit, and then taken back to the camp. And that procedure, the other thing they wanted to do was improve the nutrition of the camps. They tried to do that as well. And so a year later, in summer 1943, mortality was reduced by one-tenth. Sorry, it was 10 times less than 42. So the whole procedure was effective. And let's be clear, I'd like readers to be, listeners to be clear about this, that once zyklon started to be used in the camps, mortality went down. It did not go up, okay?
And the other thing, yes.
Yeah, the other thing you might want to be clear about is that you've got data for different ethnic groups in the camp, and Jews are roughly about 40% of the total, okay? And their mortality, this is both from the death books of Auschwitz and from the Arison archives, I'll explain those if you like, those are the two main sources recording deaths. They do not show Jews as dying differentially from the others. Over a year or two, their mortality is much the same as any other group mortality. So there's no selective dying of Jews more than other groups, okay?
Right. Yeah, you know what? And you're so spot on. I remember reading your book, and it just – I mean, I was already pretty familiar with a lot of the revisionist perspectives about the Holocaust, but truthfully, and I'm not just saying this to praise you on this show. I really do mean this. Your book provided the most clarity and really kind of helped me understand exactly what was going on during World War II and what the Germans were doing. And really, it's like the most shocking and like startling revelation to really come to grips with, you know, relating to this, is that the Germans were actually very professional and very caring for the people that were in their custody, right? I mean, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can objectively say that if you really look at what was going on, really look at the evidence. And again, this is coming from official sources. You know, you have a very long discussion about the how do you pronounce it? Bletchley Park Decrypts?
Bletchley Park.
The British intelligence monitoring the German communications, what they were doing at these camps. It proves that the Germans were, again, very professional, very caring. They wanted to save these people's lives if they could.
They wanted to provide
sanitary living conditions, and they really wanted to maintain a productive labor, you know, labor force for the war effort. That's what it was all about.
They did come into the camps. The horror came from British American bombing the whole of Middle Europe. 2 million tons of bombs were dropped on Middle Europe, and basically anything that moved was liable to get bombed. And the camps, in the end, they didn't even have water, let alone food. And therefore, you know, there was frightful mortality, which was then used by the in a sort of pornography of violence that we got at the end of the war to kind of indicate and blame the Germans.
Yes. Isn't the whole narrative, the whole official narrative, is like almost totally backwards. It's like the exact opposite of what really was going on. I mean, you know, the Jewish media and our political establishment has totally demonized the Germans and totally demonized Adolf Hitler as like this monster that they were out like specifically to murder Jews, when it's the total opposite. They were just trying to do their best to provide, you know, good living conditions and to maintain this.
For a war they never wanted.
For a war they never wanted, for a war that they were trying
they put
to
out
settle.
Whole cascade of peace offers to Britain
all the way
through the war. Non-stop cascade of peace offers that they never wanted that. Whereas I've got a chapter. I mean, I hate to say this, Jews were saying all through the 1930s that they were going to have a war against Hitler. They're going to bring on a war. It was going to happen. Hitler didn't want war, but they were going to bring it on to him. And then when the war had started, they said, "Yeah, this is our war, even though we're not there in the trenches. We're morally supporting you." They first declared war in 1933 against Hitler. I think they very much made it happen.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they certainly made it happen. Generating the PR, running cover for this narrative, this idea that, you know, Germans and Hitler, especially, and the Nazis were these monsters that hated the Jews, hated, you know, other, you know, non-Aryans or however they termed it. They wanted to conquer the world. You know, you still hear people saying these things
when it's so
baseless. It's like, again, the opposite of,
well, the only
of what they were really
that,
about.
John, is that if the different bits of Germany were allowed to come together, that was the key question for both world wars. Can the different bits of Europe, where the people think they're German and have the same culture and the same language and the same relatives, can they be allowed to live together in one country? And if they had, if that had been allowed, then that would be a very large and powerful country, especially if it's got colonies. It would have challenged the British Empire It could have been seen as a challenge to the British Empire, because it would be quite a powerful country with the Germans.
Right.
You know, they've got the best technology.
Yeah.
That's the only sense. I don't think there's any hint whatever that they wanted any world domination. I mean, compared with the British Empire, which is vast, they just wanted Germans to be allowed to live together.
Yes, yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I do think that the British political establishment, by and large, certainly viewed Germany as a threat to their, you know, worldwide domination, essentially. I think that was very real. And that was sort of, that's like a reoccurring theme all throughout European history, is like the balance of power of Europe. and England and the UK really viewing a strong, unified Germany as a major threat to their interests in Europe, but also globally. So I think you're absolutely right about that.
That was Sir Churchill's philosophy. He said England must oppose the strongest power in Europe. He says it's always done that. That's a kind of permanent war philosophy, you know.
Yes.
It used to be France. Before that, it was Italy. And now after Germany, it's Russia. That we always this country always has to have an enemy. In both cases, both world wars, as Kaiser Wilhelm, First World War, and then Adolf Hitler, Second World War, the thing they most wanted was friendship with Britain. You know, they kept trying. Was there any way they could develop friendship with Britain? No, they couldn't. No, they had to be the enemy. No, there had to be war. They somehow got outwitted by the Brits to generate the wars.
Right. You know what? And there's a really good documentary that you can still find on YouTube. I believe if you just type in Hitler's War, I remember there was a website, Justice for Germans.
Oh, is that David Irving's book?
No, it's not. I don't even think it's based on David Irving's book. If I'm not mistaken, it's actually a German documentary that you can find this on YouTube. There's English subtitles in the video that I'm talking about. In fact, if you go over to therealistreport.com and check out that article I recently published, How the Holocaust Was Faked, it's a pretty long, article that I actually wrote a few years ago, but I recently kind of updated it and expanded it and republished it on my website. Right, actually, on International Holocaust Remembrance Day, I wanted to publish it on that day to get a revisionist perspective out there, or at least my take on the Holocaust, how I would try to explain it. But you can find the video that I'm talking about right in that blog post, and you can also find it on YouTube. It's fascinating. It really, I mean, it proves that the Germans were not interested in starting a world war. They were not interested in taking over the world or oppressing other people. They simply wanted to, you know, basically rectify the injustices of the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah.
To borrow a modern cliche, make Germany great again. I mean, that's what Hitler was really all about.
Just to come back to what you said about the Treaty of Versailles, the thing is, he did go beyond that. So he united with Austria, okay? Now, just to explain to your readers, Austria had been at the kind of center of Germany. People have thought they were German for 1,000 years. It was the ruling family of Germany lived in Austria, okay, the Habsburgs. So before the boundaries of Germany were drawn up around about 1880, Austria was always like part of Germany, okay? And it spoke German, had the same culture. And then when the nation of Germany had its boundaries drawn up around about 1880, Austria wasn't in it, okay? It was a separate country. And so before and after the First World War, Austria wanted to be part of Germany, and it asked if it could be part of Germany. And I think when that union with Austria took place, which, by the way, it wasn't an act of aggression or war, as Nuremberg tried to make out, when Hitler went into Austria, he got greeted with cheering crowds, throwing flowers in his path, and there was not a shot fired in anger. You know, it's important to appreciate that was a uniting of two countries. I think they totally wanted to be together. But that did then mean that with you had other bits from the Treaty of Versailles also put back together in Germany. It was larger than before, and that was the great danger that Hitler couldn't really cope with, that his country was becoming too large and powerful, if you know what I mean.
Right, okay. Well, you know what, Nick, we only have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and I really wanted to kind of promote your book. It's called Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. And, you know, you've published a number of books over the years. I'll actually have a link to your Amazon author page. Where, you know, you can check out all of, the books that you've published over the years. A lot of them are available, at very reasonable prices. You can get a lot of them, on Kindle. The one book you can't buy though on Amazon, as we mentioned at the very beginning, is this book, Breaking the Spell, Holocaust, Myth or Reality. Yeah, you can get it from the Barnes Review, and I would encourage people to do just that. I myself have a copy. I purchased a copy shortly after you published it, which was what, 2015, I think, right? Didn't you publish it in 2014?
14.
Oh, yeah. 2014. Okay. Yeah. So it's been out there for, 5 years or so. And again, it's one of the best books I've read dealing with the Holocaust. I actually read it and wrote a review, which you can find published at therealistreport.com. I have a section for for book and movie.
There are loads of comments on Amazon, real in-depth discussion, and it's heartbreaking that they all got deleted,
Yeah, but, it's an absolute travesty. Yeah.
Yours is still up. Yeah. Thanks very much, John. Yeah.
Yeah. No. It was a pleasure to write this. It pretty much wrote itself. I mean, it was just an incredible read. A book that you could sit down and just start reading and not want to put down. I mean, you got to get to the end of it. It's really that good. Let me I'll have a link to this review that I'm talking about in this blog post for this for a radio program. Let me just briefly read a little bit of what I wrote here. And this was published again in January of 2015 when I originally wrote this.
All right, yeah.
And I write here, "Breaking the Spell: The Holocaust Myth and Reality," is a well-written and well-researched treatise entirely and conclusively debunking the official Holocaust narrative endlessly promoted and perpetuated by the mass media, Hollywood, the Western political and educational establishment, and the organized international Jewish community. Yeah. The book also touches upon a variety of other important issues as well, all of which relate directly to the false Holocaust story, including the concept of free speech, intellectual integrity, critical thinking, and the future of humanity.
Oh, wow.
Quote, "I say there cannot be a happy future for mankind," Dr. Carlstrom courageously declares, "so long as this nightmare delusion that people call the Holocaust remains in place." And I totally agree with that sentiment. Oh, my goodness. You know what? Think about it. The Holocaust is literally one of the biggest lies of history.
It's a nightmare from hell, straight from hell, from hell nightmare. And it's also a false religion. People have a religious intensity about this belief.
Oh, yeah.
It is a straight from hell false religion. Yeah.
Well, and you know what? It's incredible because, I'll get criticized from time to time by people that say, you focus too much on the Holocaust and, revisionism. And my response is, look, I mean, I turn on my computer every day, start going through my emails, check out Twitter, and I'm literally being encountered with the fake Holocaust story every single day.
We're getting a whole bloody new Holocaust temple built right next to our House of Commons in London.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Well, think about just the other night, President Trump gave the State of the Union address. He's literally celebrating and praising quote unquote Holocaust survivors. It's insane. I mean, we're 70, 80 years after the alleged Holocaust. Yeah. And the President of the United States, a man who ran on a platform of building a wall and deporting illegal aliens and putting America first and getting out of these disastrous wars in the Middle East. He wants to get up here in the most prime, address to the nation and talk about Holocaust survivors. Are you kidding me? How can I not cover this? How can we not continue to talk about the Holocaust when it is a weaponized narrative?
World War II that a whole lot of people ever hear about, it's the only bit of the war that they know about. It's more intensively taught in British schools than I reckon anything else.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. No, it is. It absolutely is. It is constantly brought up and reinforced and perpetuated, not only in our educational establishment, but in the media, and even by our political leaders. Not a day goes by without some invocation of the alleged Holocaust and the horrors of Nazism. And, it really is the foundation of the entire New World Order agenda. It really is.
Well, let's say, may the power of truth prevail. Let's have that affirmation that we have to believe that we, our fellow citizens, are capable of perceiving truth. And we can do that through debate, informed debate. We have to believe that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And your book certainly promotes that, and that's a major theme throughout. And I think, you know, the revisionist perspective really does embody that sort of mindset and champions that sort of
thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's certainly what I'm all about. That's certainly what you're all about, it sounds like. And, and I totally salute you. And I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today, especially for, you know, for staying up so late on a Sunday night.
Oh, it's a pleasure, John. A pleasure. Yeah.
Yeah, I do appreciate it. Yeah. And we'll definitely have to do this again. I will, as I mentioned, I will have a link to your Amazon page. I do encourage everybody to support your work, to check it out, to purchase some of your books, to purchase Breaking the Spell, certainly. The Barnes Review is a great place to do that, and to subscribe to the Barnes Review. You know, it's pretty much the last publication, you know, publishing this sort of material and dealing with these issues from a professional, scholarly perspective, and I think it's important. Yeah. So,
the great American historian Harry Elmer Barnes, as we mentioned, the First World War, he wrote important books about World War I and World War II. If you can get hold of his stuff, you know, and the Barnes Review is named after him.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Nick, thank you so much, my friend. I really do appreciate it. I'd love to do this again in the future, and I wish you the best, sir.
Okay, cheers, John.
All right, thank you, and thanks everybody for tuning in.
All right, okay, bye for now.